is CBS Eye on the World. Here's John Batchelor.
King Charles III, assuming the throne at the end of his mother's very successful 70 years, at the same time there's a change of government in Parliament, not profoundly. The Conservatives choose another premier. However, these events give an opportunity to discuss with Gregory Copley, the editor and publisher of Defense and Foreign Affairs, about global Britain, about Britain in the Commonwealth, about Britain in the 21st century, or as Gregory says in a recent publication, revolutionary Britain. Gregory, a very good evening to you. King Charles III, long prepared for the role that he now assumes. He's a vivid-looking man in his uniforms, his many uniforms, and I look forward to his crowning. However, at this moment, we're told, this is through voices speaking around the crown, that he means to modernize the throne. What does that mean to you? Is that a revolution to modernize the throne? What will it look for? And at the same time, how does that fit into these doubts in the Commonwealth about republicanism versus constitutional monarchy? Good evening to you.
Good evening, John. Well, I think the doubts which are expressed in the media do not reflect the doubts about the role of constitutional monarchy in most of the population of the Commonwealth, and particularly those members of the Commonwealth which have the crown as their own head of state, such as Canada, Australia, and New Zealand. So I think the popularity of constitutional monarchy throughout much of the British Commonwealth is intact. It's a system which works. It generally sits atop Westminster-style parliamentary governance, which gives a lot of fluidity and balance to the elections and so on. And the crown sits above that, and giving continuity. I don't think that process is any less popular. You do have some radical politicians in Canada, Australia, and New Zealand who would consider republics, but the population is not with them on that. When the last referendum in Australia was held in, I think, 1999, about whether to move from the constitutional monarchy to a republic, that was at a time when the crown was at its nadir, with the crisis over Princess Diana and so on, and yet the referendum had 2/3 of Australians voting to retain the constitutional monarchy and being very sceptical about a politically driven republic, and today the crown is even more popular in those Commonwealth countries than it was in 1999. We see the whole concept of revolutionary Britain at the heart of this, if you like, not just with the transition from Queen Elizabeth II to King Charles III, but also with the fact that the British government itself and the British polity have undergone radical transformations. The Conservative government, you mentioned rightly that they've been in power for some time, has now become more traditionally conservative. It's gone back on the warpath against big government, against the control of policy by the bureaucracy rather than by elected politicians. It wants to slim down the state sector, and it wants to reduce taxes, all of which is music to the ears of most of the electorate, and particularly all of those people who voted for the Conservative Party, switching often after as much as a century in their districts from Labour to the Conservatives. So this is quite profound. So you've got a radical new government, which is a slimmed down government. You've got a monarchy, which, as you say, is being slimmed down under King Charles. And you have Britain now back in business because it's removed itself from the European Union. We have to think of the European Union sojourn for Britain as being a convalescent home after Britain had exhausted itself, literally after World War II and the like, and eventually went into the old age home of the European Union. Now, having started to take its vitamins again, removed itself from the European Union and is on the path once again to global trade, as opposed to allowing itself to be submerged into a European-oriented trading and political system. It's very much a revolution. And if you look at the doubts and concerns or nervousness about King Charles III coming to office, think about the similar situation when Queen Victoria died in 1901 and her wayward son, the Prince of Wales, became King Edward VII. And there were great fears that he'd spent far too long in the apprenticeship to take over the crown. He was too old and so on. And yet when Edward VII came in, he transformed from being the wastrel that he was, if you like, and womanizer as the Prince of Wales, to becoming a modernizing king who really revitalized the British economy and strategic situation in the Edwardian era. So the Edwardian era was very profoundly positive for Britain and enabled it to successfully fight in World War One. Admittedly with many impediments as the century went on, but nonetheless, it revived Britain. And I think we'll see the same under King Charles. Yes, he spent 73 years preparing for this moment, and yet he is incredibly vibrant. His work ethic beats most people's. He's a seven-day-a-week worker. He works day and night, and he's an independent thinker. What we saw, though, as Prince of Wales, we will not see as King. As Prince of Wales, he was free to express himself. He had views on the economy, the ecology, and on architecture, on human relations and religion and the like. He made it clear he would that would all go silent once he became King, because now it is not his job to talk. It's his job to listen and to protect the constitutional rights of his population. And in fact, that's the one thing about constitutional monarchy. Its primary role is to provide continuity and to protect its citizens against the excesses of government.
I want to speak to the future in a moment, Gregory, but I want to start with the past, because I've been following, thanks to your reporting and because it's there, the London papers about criticism of the Commonwealth. The Commonwealth represents an historical transformation of the British Empire into different geographies around the world. Your native Australia, for example. The Commonwealth is very strong there, as I understand it. Queen Elizabeth was very keen to visit Australia as often as possible over her many decades, I think 16 times in all. What does the Commonwealth mean to the people in Australia, to the young people born now? How do they learn about it? What does it represent to their future, given that Australia is transforming itself with immigration from Asia into a mixed culture of many religions? It's beginning to look like America. So what does the Commonwealth mean for them?
Well, it's very interesting that the rise in popularity of the monarchy and of the Commonwealth has been profound in the last two, three decades, at a time when, as you say, immigration has been quite dramatic, and it's immigration from countries which were never part of the Commonwealth or Empire, a lot of Asian people coming into Australia and the like. And yet these are the people, particularly the young people, who have expressed their support for both the Crown and the Commonwealth. The Commonwealth is a win-win situation. If you think of the Empire as being London-centric, then the Commonwealth is not. The Commonwealth is, if you like, an equal trading opportunity for all of its members to trade with each other and with Britain. It shares a lot of common values. Many of its members are parliamentary democracies with a Westminster style of government, which is the same as Britain, and that particularly applies, of course, to not only Britain but the three dominions: Canada, Australia, New Zealand. So there's an easy linkage, if you like, in terms of trade, politics, policies, the way their armed forces run. This is why the new AUKUS agreement, the Australia-United Kingdom-United States treaty, it really fitted well with Britain and Australia. Now have Australian naval personnel training on Royal Navy nuclear submarines. There's an interoperable aspects of all of the members of the armed forces and the like. So so basically, it's a very comfortable fit. It's and it's a no-lose situation if you are a state which is a member of the Commonwealth, because it gives you trade advantages that you don't have to negotiate in terms of like free trade agreements and the like. You've already got a lot of free trade and other linkages built into that relationship, which you can avail yourself or not. But right now, I suspect that the Truss government, given Liz Truss's background in negotiating new trade agreements when she was Foreign Secretary, is such that she will be emphasizing how the Commonwealth can best be used to boost mutual trade and human interaction, the freedom of movement of many of the peoples and the like, which is already emblematic of the Commonwealth. So all of these things really make the Commonwealth a win-win situation for its members.
And the big pieces of the Commonwealth, the big pieces, Canada, Australia, New Zealand, are they something that Charles needs to do something new with? Because the history there is, well, we could mention South Africa too. All of these are parts of the British Empire that were seen as prosperous or especially rich in resources, a lot of out-migration from Britain. Are they especially needful of Charles, the modern king? And how can he serve those parts? I know that there are 54 nations. Some are former British Empire, some are not. But I'm looking at the four big pieces. Do they need him?
Oh, yes. I think that the activities around the Queen's funeral and about the king's emergence were a great boost to a sense of identity and empire and belonging to those main dominions that emerged from the empire. South Africa may be the exception, although there's a huge percentage of the population, both the English speaking and the Afrikaans, who are really very, very grateful to be part of glad to be part of the empire. But basically, the People's Republic of China has subsumed the government of South Africa today, right. and that's why it's declining. But the rest of them, it's very strongly supportive of Charles. But the Charles will have to act not only to stamp his popularity on those countries, and that's going to require some visits there as soon as possible, and also some visits into the South Pacific areas and the smaller countries such as Papua New Guinea, even down to places like the Solomon Islands and the like, so that they don't go over to the People's Republic of China and realize what they've got in their
Commonwealth. And that is the challenge, Gregory. We'll go there next. The challenge for global Britain, the challenge for revolutionary Britain, it's the People's Republic of China. This 100 years ago, this would not have been imaginable, what is opposing London. But today, it's Beijing. Gregory Copley, editor and publisher of Defense and Foreign Affairs, writing of revolutionary Britain under King Charles III and the Tory government, 12 years in power and no end in sight. I'm John Batchelor.